absorption, deep samadhi. And also a teaching of the Buddhas called dependent origination, or codependent arising, as it's sometimes referred to. And so, since I'm going to be offering that teaching at the retreat, I thought maybe I would share some of the high points of that teaching here this evening. And it's not, you know, when the Buddha began to teach himself, and then when he started training others to teach, and it was one of the sort of the precepts that we undertook when I completed my seminary program, you think, I will teach a graduated discourse, which is to say, I'm going to keep it simple at the outset and just lay out some of the basics, and then little bit by little bit by little bit, things that are a little more abstruse or sort of difficult to grasp or make sense of, you know, I'll mix in later on. And so with a lot of these teachings of the Buddha, whether it was his teachings on, you know, after a while, after, you know, a couple of years and a bunch of sitting and going to a few retreats and doing some reading, you kind of start to grasp this notion of the ennobling truths of the reality of suffering and where it comes from, how the mind creates it, how the mind can let it go, how to cultivate the path that leads to ultimate cessation of suffering, and then the aspects of that path. And then a little later on, I would go on retreats and my teachers would start introducing other teachings. And one of the core teachings of the Buddha, one of the things that most radically differentiates the teachings of Buddha Dharma from all the other major world religions and wisdom traditions, which tend to be theistic and tend to posit, you know, an omniscient, omnipotent being and a permanent and abiding self. The way that Buddhism is most substantially differentiated from all these others is that it does neither of those things. It does not posit an omniscient, omnipotent being, and it does not posit the existence of an eternal and abiding self. And so in that regard, it's really quite different. It's what the Buddha called going against the stream or against the grain, because it was wholly unlike any of the teachings that were being offered at the time. And so what the Buddha instead, you know, and the dominant religious tradition of his time in India, northeastern India, was Brahmanism. And that posited the existence of an omniscient, omnipotent being, was the theistic tradition, Brahma, and of a permanent and abiding self, a soul, an eternal soul, Atman. And so what the Buddha taught in the alternative was a teaching, a set of teachings that he called Anatman, Anatta, the teaching of not self. So what he taught was that instead of the self being something that was permanent and always there and eternal and that would be reincarnated from, you know, lifetime to lifetime, what he taught instead is that what we think of as self, as who we are, is something in fact that the mind creates, that the mind actually conjures a sense of self. It does so on a moment-to-moment basis. Okay. And when I first heard that teaching, I really didn't have anywhere to put it. It just sounded weird and foreign and unlike the other traditions, like the one I was raised in, originally in the Baptist church, you know, it said, believe on these things and you shall be saved. Do not believe on these things and you shall, you know, basically burn in hell. You know, it's pretty binary. And the commandment was to believe. Okay. And in a lot of traditions, it's somewhat the same way. This is the doctrine. You adhere to the doctrine, you're one of us. You don't, you're not. Okay. When the Buddha started to teach, he didn't say, you know, everything you think you know about how things are is wrong. You know, how you believe is wrong, how I believe is right, believe how I believe, and, you know, and you'll be free of suffering. He came at it from a completely different perspective. Instead, it was not a commandment, it was an invitation. He said, abide contemplating the possibility that what I say is so. Just take it in. Reflect on it. You know, and his phrase was eipasiko. Come see for yourself. Just listen to what I have to say. My goal in seeking liberation was to find out how the mind causes suffering and how we can train the mind to stop doing that. Right? He said, if that's your goal as well, I invite you to listen to what I have to say. If on having heard what I have to say, it makes sense to you, it resonates with your own understanding, with your own experience, then you may want to try these practices that I recommend. You may want to try, you know, looking at the mind, reflecting on the nature of mind in the way that I recommend. If in fact, on doing so, you find that it begins to create liberation from suffering, go with it. You know, so that was the invitation, not a commandment, not that's not how it is, it's like this instead. It's like this based on my own experience is what I've learned to be. You know, if you find that to be your own experience as well, then definitely follow this path. If you don't, then go listen to somebody else. You know, go check out another path. So I really struggle with this notion of anatta or not self until on one retreat, I was really struggling with it. I think the mind was somewhat offended by it actually. And I got sort of deeper into meditation and I was just observing what the mind was up to. And this realization came that, you know, I think he's right. There's nobody home. It really is nothing more than a rapidly occurring sequence of mental processes. And that had the effect of kind of shifting my understanding not only of the nature of mind, but also where our motivations come from, how we relate to other people. And it began to sort of invite another way of looking at things, looking how the world works. And teachings I'd heard the Buddha say before, all of a sudden, had a lot more relevance. When he began to talk about how the mind creates suffering, okay, he talked about how, in addition to creating the suffering for ourselves, the mind has a very powerful disinclination to realize that that's what it's doing. That it has a real desire to reside in ignorance. And when the Buddha used the term ignorance, and as it's used actually in Buddha Dharma, it really has quite a different meaning, different connotation than it does in the West. When we use the word ignorance in the West, mostly what we are referring to is a simple lack of knowledge. Ignorant of a certain set of facts. Ignorant of, you know, the laws of thermodynamics. Just not knowing, not having knowledge of them. In Buddha Dharma, in particular, it's probably helpful to pronounce that word not as ignorance, but as ignorance. In the West, the Western connotation is a passive one, which is to say, I simply don't know about that. They simply don't have knowledge of that phenomenon. In the context of this teaching of dependent origination, okay, how the mind conjures self, ignorance is ignorance. It's not a passive state of mind, it's an active state of mind. It's the mind's active desire to not know and to not see. It's an active desire to not know, to not see how it is that the mind creates suffering. The way the Buddha described this, he said, you know, for those in the world who have no desire to develop insight into how we cause suffering for ourselves and how it might be brought to an end. Okay. People in that state of mind are like a herd of cows. He said, if you regard a herd of cows, in the evenings they stay in their barn. And you know, he was living in an agrarian society, so he used agrarian similes all the time. In the morning, the barn doors are opened, and the cows come forth, and they go from the barn up into the pastures where they're going to graze for the day. So they're drawn by their desires. They know where the pastures are, and they know that they'll be able to go up there and spend the day chowing down. They are herded by a cowherd, and in that custom, in that time, cowherds had a really long, stout pole. And so whenever the cows would start to wander off in one direction or another and not head for the pasture where they were supposed to go, the cowherd would come along and whack them, you know, knock them back into line so they would stay on the same path and make their way up to their designated pasture. And so Buddha said, the unenlightened and the uninterested, the incurious, are like a herd of cows. They're drawn by their desires and they're driven by their fears. You know, they fear being harmed by the stick and they want to go up to the pasture and spend the day chowing down. Furthermore, the cowherd, if he doesn't do his job right, and the cattle wander off, you know, he's going to get whacked, right? So he's actually operating out of fear as well. Okay. So the cows go up into the pasture, drawn by their desires, driven by their fears, and they spend the day grazing. At the end of the day, they return back to the barn. Okay. Once again, they're drawn by their desires. You know, to have a little grain and water back in the barn, to return to the safety of the barn where predators can't get at them. And once again, the cowherd's coming along right behind with his big long rod, and if they try to wander off or go somewhere else, he whacks them again. So they're once again drawn by their desires and driven by their fears. And that becomes the cycle of their life, over and over and over again. It's kind of a metaphor for this wheel of samsara, you know, the endless rounds of birth and death, you know, in an unenlightened state, drawn by desire, driven by fear. Until finally, the Buddha says, they're ultimately led to slaughter. And that's it. That's the life of the unenlightened, of the incurious, of those who have no desire to look more deeply into the nature of mind, to find out why we suffer. And there are a lot of kinds of suffering that come along with being in a body, and the kinds of suffering that come along with being social beings, you know, being in social contact with each other. So when loved ones become ill or die, or you know, we find ourselves really drawn to and attached to those we love, and we feel great remorse when something bad happens, you know, to one of these people, or where you fall out of a relationship, or, you know, just painful things happen, right? So there are the kinds of suffering that are occasioned by that. The kind of suffering the Buddha talked about was the one that that the mind creates for itself. And it comes from, as the Buddha taught, attachment, craving and clinging. He said there are certain things that the mind craves, that certain ways that it wants things to be that are not necessarily how they are. Okay. So the mind craves certainty. It craves consistency. It craves pleasure. It craves avoiding pain. And it has no interest in anything else, attachment, aversion, and delusion. So that's the kind of the program that we got dealt, right? And what it leads to, if you do nothing more than succumb to that, the way the Buddha taught it, is living a life as a cow. Driven by, you know, drawn by desires, driven by fears, until finally the end comes. And so what the Buddha said was that if you desire to be free from this endless round of rebirths, you need to start paying careful attention to why it is that this is going on in the first place. And so that's what this teaching of dependent origination is all about. The teaching of what constitutes the wheel of samsara, how the mind actually goes about creating self. Because he said that once you are able to really look closely at this process, you know, I call it sort of putting together a, you know, iMac or a MeMac or something, you know, it's the Buddha said that the, you know, that which we take to be self is nothing more than the five aggregates affected by clinging. What are these five aggregates? The skandhas, that are khandhas in Pali. That just means like a heap or a gathering. And so the simile the Buddha used was like, you know, if in a great household there is a granary that has several different kinds of grain, and the chief cook or the cook's, you know, the chef's apprentice goes to the granary, and there are these different heaps of different kinds of grain, like millet and oats and wheat and corn, you know, rice, whatever. And so then the chef or the chef's assistant takes a certain amount of each of these things needed in order to create the meal for the day, and the baking for the day. And then brings them back to the kitchen, and they're combined. So the Buddha talked about these skandhas in this way. And he said that they consist of, insofar as how we conjure the self, they consist of the body itself. Okay. Nama rupa, name and form, our physical existence. They consist of our sense doors and the mind's ability to process sensory input, to make an immediate judgment as to whether the sensory input is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So we make judgments about the environment that we're in, how we're being informed by our senses. And the third ingredient in all this is perception. It's the mind's ability to take the sensory input and identify it as something. Okay, is that pop I just heard a gunshot or a car backfiring? Is it fireworks or is it an incoming round that might take out half my platoon? You know, it's all kind of contextual. You hear the sound and you immediately judge it to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then the mind starts to work really hard to identify what is that? The next thing that happens is the engagement of what are called the sankharas. That's all of our memories and all of our conditions, every element of life experience that we have undergone up until this moment in time. So there's been the sound or the input, it's been judged to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, it's been identified, and then you go through the memory banks. You know, it might be a fragrance, and you know, like a particular flower or something, and so you smell it, you judge it to be pleasant, you identify it as the fragrance of a star jasmine or some flower. And then the sankharas, the mental formations, the mind says, oh right, I remember when I smell that fragrance. You know, and you can remember the setting, and maybe it was a really pleasant one, you know, and so it brings back a good memory. And then the fifth element is the part of the mind that's conscious of everything that's going on. Okay. So those are the sort of the constituent elements of self, the way the Buddha taught. Whether or not they wind up creating self, coming together like atoms into a molecule, okay, is the, again, the Buddha defined self as the five aggregates affected by clinging, which is to say the mind in some way or another wants things to be different than they are. Okay. So the clinging might be, it could be something as simple as, front of Lick's ice cream and say, oh, you know, I've really been good to myself here lately, you know, I've been following a diet and I've lost a few pounds, and so I think I deserve a reward, and so I think I'm going to go over and see what Lick's has to offer tonight. And so you go over there and you say, well, you know, I remember I've really had problems in the past with, you know, overdoing it when it comes to ice cream, so maybe I'll just get a little taste of, you know, one scoop of something, and you, well, I can't really decide which flavor I want. Maybe I should get like three small packages of my favorites, you know, and I'll take them home. But I'll only have a small taste of each one. Want to get it right? So all of a sudden, here's the mind. You spent the, you know, the last hour or two here becoming clear-minded, you know, becoming aware of your senses, aware of your motivations and your intentions. But all of a sudden, you're faced with ice cream, and it becomes a problem. So,
how does guilty already?
You good pre-guilt? Yeah, that's a special one. So that's the five aggregates, and then the rest of the processes that go into construing self. So there is ignorance, right? So let's say, you know, you've got a little bit of an issue with ice cream. You know, it kind of tests your boundaries of self-control. And so you're kind of maybe standing in the corner, should I even go over there? I know I might get in trouble if I do that. Maybe I should just get in my car and go home or walk back to my apartment. And you say, well, no, I'm feeling quite balanced. I can do this. You know, I'm a grown-up in the world. And so I'll go over and I'll check it out. I'll see what's happening. Volition has come into play. I have decided that instead of just walking home, I'm going to go over to Lick's and I'm going to see what kind of flavors they have tonight. So you've exercised the volition to go over there. You're also playing a little game, you know, like when they, you know, Abe Lincoln used to talk about the better angels of our nature, or, you know, or the good one on one shoulder and the bad one on the other, and then. So that's kind of what's going on with the sankharas. And within your memories, you have the memory of, you know, the last time you OD'd on ice cream. and how it just really wasn't good, you know. And you know that it's a weak area for you and you probably shouldn't indulge it. But then there's the other part of you that says, oh no, I'm on top of it now. You know, I'm more mindful than I used to be. I'm more balanced, you know. There's no way I could really allow myself to go down that same road. So maybe I'll go over and check it out. you go over there and you're, right now it's just in a kind of a wispy idea in the back of your mind, but then you see some flavor, oh wow, whoa, I've had that one before, it's really good, you know, some kind of mint chip or whatever, you know, I gotta get some of that, and, oh yeah, I remember that one too, and so you get some of that craving is kicked in, right, and so, okay, well, you know, so I'm gonna get myself some ice cream, but I'm really a good person. I've been working hard. I'm sure that I can take this stuff back home and eat it in a mindful way. You know, measured portions. What's going on is the, you know, the different sankharas, the memories of how things got out of hand, and then there is the ignorance that steps in and it crushes out that memory with a big hairy paw and says, you know, oh no, you're fine. You won't, you know, you won't succumb this time. This time will be different, right? And so you go ahead and you buy your favorite flavors and you take them home. And you start, you know, and you put just a little bit from all three into your dish. You start eating and, oh wow, that's really good. And then you're getting close to the end and say, oh my goodness, I've finished two of them faster than the other one. I really need to make things come out even. So maybe I should put just a little more in and then eat them mindfully so they all come out even, right? So you do it again, and then maybe the same thing has happened. And then clinging has happened, and then in the blink of an eye, you move into the stage of becoming, of giving birth to a person who is obsessed with satiating yourself on ice cream. You brought into being this person who gorges on ice cream. And then right after that, you realize you've eaten everything in all three cartons, and all of a sudden, you really don't feel so good. The body is full and it feels kind of sated, and there's this kind of nasty sweet taste in your mouth, right? And what happens in that moment in time is there, you've given birth to the person sating themselves on ice cream. And then you have this feeling of revulsion toward the person who sated themselves on ice cream. Okay. And so that person dies. That's another one of the steps in this cycle of dependent origination. What happens then is you give birth to another self. And that is a self that feels shame and guilt and strong self-aversion. Oh, you know, I've done it again. What a spineless wretch I am, you know. I've just gone and polluted my body as I have over and over again in the past, and lamenting the ignorance that led you into this state that caused you to do this thing. Okay. And so now you have given birth to a person that hates themselves and that has no faith in themselves, that considers themselves to be worthless, and hopeless, and incapable of self-improvement, incapable of self-healing. I'm using the example of ice cream. It's true for any addiction. For anyone who has ever felt themselves to be under the sway of any addictive substance, whether it's food or alcohol or medications. It's a familiar pattern. You know, we know the struggle. We know this battle between the memories in sankhara and the ignorance, that which wants to not acknowledge how much of a problem we might have with that particular substance, whatever it happens to be. Okay. And so in, you know, one of the ways the Buddha Dharma works with freeing oneself from addictive dependency is that, and this is, you know, to some extent, this is also used in many existing recovery programs. What happens when you find yourself in the depths of that self-aversion and negative self-judgment? There's this real hopelessness. I am someone who is incapable of freeing myself from this. And certainly in the classical 12-step programs, you know, instead of just saying, well, worthless shit, and I should just give up, you know, it's acknowledging that I have lost my control over the substance, that it controls me instead, and I need help getting out of this, right? In Buddha Dharma, it's a little different because there's no self. So when we find ourselves in this deep trough of self-aversion, I am hopeless, I am worthless, I am powerless, I, that's where the break happens. So when this cycle is going on in the realm of samsara, and you find that this powerful self-aversion has arisen, and you've given birth to the self-aversive person, okay, then what happens is, when we're doing insight practice, what happens with insight practice is that we have, in addition to everything else that's going on, we have cultivated the power of mindfulness, which is the ability of the mind to step back and look at what's going on. So instead of just being immersed in this cycle, you know, on the wheel of samsara, and being like the cows, you know, just ignorant, you know, livestock going round and round and round, the power of mindfulness allows us to kind of step back and say, oh, this is what's going on. And that thought, I am a worthless person, I am a powerless person, okay, transforms itself into, that's not who I am. That's who the mind conjured myself to be in the previous moment. Because there is no permanent and abiding self. What's happening is that the mind is creating self moment by moment by moment by moment by moment. So mindfulness allows us to see, oh, that thought that I am a worthless, powerless person is just a thought. It was the mind conjuring up that self. And when mindfulness can see that that's what's going on, you can say, that is dukkha. That is suffering. And out of that recognition that the mind has created suffering comes compassion. Oh, look how I have caused myself to suffer through the activities of mind. And so then you start doing self-compassion practice, you know. And the phrases for that, you know, in the classic Southeast Asian tradition, is you begin with gestures and phrases of forgiveness for any ways I may have caused harm to myself, knowingly or unknowingly, through anything I've said or thought or done, I ask forgiveness. And then you respond, "For any ways I may have suffered harm by reason of anything that I thought or said or did, I forgive myself." And that breaks the cycle. You lose attachment to the person who hates themselves. And instead, you relax into this field of compassion, of self-forgiveness, of understanding of this cycle that gave rise to the suffering that you've undergone, that clearly sees the links between the ignorance and the way the body has been conditioned, and all of our memories. The memories in there that are trying to draw your attention, say, "Don't go there, don't do that. You know, remember how much it hurts. Remember how much harm you've done to yourself." And then that, oftentimes, that memory just kind of being blocked out again by ignorance. You know, but now you can see that it's a really kind of an impersonal process. It's just kind of like an assembly line. It's how the mind works, right? And in this model, in this example, you're looking at what happened after the fact, you know. But nonetheless, you're able to gain powerful insights into how you got where you are, okay? And you feel the pain of it, right? And that pain also becomes one of the sankharas, one of the mental formations, one of the things you remember. So next time around, you know, the more mindful you are of the pain, the more powerful that memory will be the next time around in terms of keeping you from inflicting further harm on yourself. So for people that have, you know, been working with any form of dependency or you know, addiction, you know, there is this, you know, remember how each time kind of got worse than the one before, and how it hurt more than the last time around, how perhaps it even became more life-threatening than the last time around, until finally there's some tipping point where you say, enough is enough, you know. I'm either going to die of this, or I'm going to take control of my own life and follow a different path. And so that's kind of what this is about. You know, it's waking up to what's going on there. Wheel of samsara. Wheel of the Dharma chakra, right? So we meditate, we exert skillful effort and concentration, we become mindful, we develop the wisdom factors, we develop insight into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are, including our own conditioning and our own dependencies, and, you know, the role that ignorance has played in bringing us to who we are. But we develop insight into who we are. And then, the other wisdom factor, we develop insight into our intentions, into the intention that precedes action. Okay. So, when we're focused on that, and we know, we see that interface between intention, you know, the wisdom factors, panya, and the factors of beneficial action in the world, you know, right speech and action and way of life, you know. We see that interface between intention and action, and we begin to wake up and say, oh, right, okay. So we can get to the point where craving may arise, but is not acted upon. So that's where skillful effort comes into play. Right, here comes the craving, you know, and whether it's stepping out onto the corner and seeing the ice cream parlor, you know, and you know your history with ice cream. Is it possible for me to go over there and get some ice cream and take it home and eat it, you know, without being overcome by craving, without being overcome by clinging, without manifesting, you know, myself into a, you know, essentially an out of control being that's then gonna inflict harm and suffer the consequences and have to go through that. Is it possible? You know, so in the wheel of samsara is that interface between the senses noting what's going on, or maybe even the craving arising and not acting on the craving. That's the same thing that happens in the Dharma wheel. It's the touch point between the two. You see the arising of intention. What is it the mind wants to do? You know, what if I act on this intention? What if I don't act on that intention? Whether it's saying or doing some unskillful thing, or something that reinforces an addiction, or that notices, I know enough about my own history, where your memories are more powerful than your ignorance, right? Because they've been married to volition, they've been married to the desire for freedom. And when those two are conjoined, you know, the memory, the clear memory, and the desire for freedom come together, they can overcome the ignorance. They can enable and empower us to follow a more positive path. That's the teaching. Let's talk about it a little bit. Let's reflect on it. If anything I said resonates with anything in your experience and you'd like to share it, please do. Or ask a question to clarify your understanding.
Your simile or the analogy of the cat drawn by desire, driven by fear, brings to mind an occurrence when I was a young boy living in a rural community where a man's barn caught on fire. And of course, curious young boys, we all piled into a car and drove out to the fire. He had managed to get the cattle out, had driven them out, had lost control of them. Mm-hmm. And we know where they went back. Mm-hmm. Right back into the burning part.
Oh my goodness.
And it's a common occurrence. The cattle have one place that they know is safe. Isn't that what we do when we're confronted by things we don't know, that we fall back into a familiar and sometimes disastrous and destructive place because we are driven by fear into that which is worse for us.
That's a remarkable story.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an image I will never, ever forget.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. Appreciate your sharing.
I was thinking as you were talking about whether I could have ever gotten sober just doing the practice,
mm-hmm.
and how critical my early recovery was and dependent on the notion of self and the need to identify that self with a disease. And then, and I struggled with this as so many of us do, the requirement in the program that we turn our will and our lives over to a power greater than ourselves.
Yes.
And in the absence of that, and it was a struggle just coming up, I thought I was going kicking and screaming into the whole God thing.
Right.
But then we became very dependent on it.
Yes.
And the notion of surrender, I know, is common in Buddhism as it is in 12-step programs.
Yes.
But it looked like God what you surrender to.
Yes.
It's a pretty scary prospect when you think about it.
Yes. A wonderful question she's asking, you know, because, you know, as inclusive as Bill Wilson and others wanted to be, it's still based on a theistic model, you know, higher power that you surrender to. In Buddha Dharma, the understanding is that within the mind, there are sort of many functions at work. One is the one I just described, the wheel of samsara, the function of creating or conjuring self. And in so doing, one perpetuates suffering. One of the Thai forest meditation masters in my tradition, Ajahn Chah, in my lineage, Ajahn Chah, would talk about what he called the one who knows. And what he meant by that was inner wisdom. And in the understanding of the, you know, in the Buddha's teaching, what he conveyed was that in addition to these other functions that the mind is capable of performing, there is this quality of inner wisdom, what one might call spiritual intuition, that knowing and healing aspect of our own consciousness that innately knows what's good for us or where we need to go. About 1,000 years after the Buddha lived, there is this compendium of the experience of monks practicing on the island of Sri Lanka called the Visuddhimagga. And there's a lot of interesting imagery in there about nature of mind and how things function. And one of the things I learned from reading the Visuddhimagga, I thought this was only like something that British sailors did, you know, in more recent times, but even back then, when sailors in trading ships on the Indian Ocean would get blown out to sea by a big storm or something like that, had no idea where they were, cloudy, they didn't have any means of navigating. What they did was they would take with them a bunch of crows. Crows are land birds, and they hate water. So what they would do is they would, you know, try to get some sense of where they thought they wanted to go, and then every day they would go out and they would release one of these crows, and the crows wanted nothing more than to be free of the ship. And so they'd fly up much higher than they could see from the ship, and they'd fly around. And one of the things about crows is as distinguished from seabirds that kind of, you know, wheel and drift and soar and whatnot, crows always fly in a straight line to wherever they want to go. And so they'd watch the crow, and it would fly around, and if it couldn't find out where it wanted to go, it'd come back to the ship. And they'd do that every day, and then eventually they'd let a crow go, and the crow would go up there and start flying around, and it would see or smell land. And when it did, it went straight off, you know, in a beeline for the land. And they knew that the crow had found land. And so they would watch, you know, it was somebody's job to watch the crow. And so they would reorient the ship and start sailing in the direction that the crow had flown. And so what the simile they used in the Visuddhimagga is they said that spiritual intuition, that inner wisdom, is like the crow. It's like it knows where it needs to go. And that inner wisdom is something that needs to be trusted in the same way. That there is this spiritual guidance system that understands what it means to be free, that understands how to live a life where we do not cause more suffering for ourselves and others, and that much of our spiritual practice is about learning to listen to that voice, you know, what Ajahn Chah again called, you know, the one who knows. And so, like in the Mahayana tradition, they talk about the two wings of awakening being wisdom and compassion. That the wisdom factor is being able to see the ways that we cause suffering for ourselves and others, how it can be avoided. The compassion factor is holding ourselves with kind regard rather than self-aversion whenever we see ourselves doing something unskillful. But those two things working together, and in this understanding, wisdom is very different from knowledge. You know, we can read books, we can gain knowledge of Buddha Dharma, you know, scholastic knowledge, we can have experiential knowledge from doing practice. But wisdom is understood to be non-cognitive, that it's something that is much more organic, something that's much more attuned to what it means to survive and thrive as a human being. And that learning to listen to that inner voice, learning to trust it, learning to be guided by it, you know, is in fact what leads one to the ultimate awakening. And so it's a little more nuanced than, you know, simply relying on an external deity, but it is the understanding that there is within each of us a spark, I don't want to call it the divine necessarily, but there is a spark of this kind of primordial wisdom that understands what it means to be in genuine attunement with all it is. You know, that the way home, you know, if you will. And in the Tibetan Buddhist texts, they talk a lot about that, you know, that spiritual awakening, spiritual maturation, the letting go is all about returning to the source from which we all came and to which we all return. So, long answer to a short, simple question. Thank you. Okay. You've gone and eaten up all our time. So let's take our sitting posture once more. I will look forward to being with you again in just about a minute's time. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always do well. Bhavatu sava mangalam, rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava dhamma nubhavena, sada sati bhava. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sava mangalam, rakantu sava devatam. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava sangha nubhavena, sada sati bhavantu. By the power of ease of suffering. May you be happy. May you be awakened. Safe journey home.